Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy. How are you?
I'm very well. You've been to the Lake District.
Oh, yeah. I love the lakes. You know, I love climbing in the lakes and walking in the lakes. I've been doing it for a long time. You know what first turned me on to the lakes was reading Lord of the Rings when I was a kid. I know this sounds like, you know, but this is in the early 70s, and then getting a school trip to go there, and I literally thought I was in Middle Earth. But there's something relevant here as well, because I was also obsessed with the whole folk revival that was happening. I mean, I can't believe I juggled it all. I'm a glam rock kid. I'm a prog rock kid, and then there's folk music, and maybe it was prog actually that led me to folk.
It would have been. Do you know what? There's a funny thing, though, if I can just interject, because I remember reading in Mickey Green's book, you know, The Clash's Road Manager, he was saying when Tony James used to share a house, a flat, with Mick Jones, he would go off rambling. He would go off to the Lake District walking, Tony James.
Yeah.
He used to do it back then, and had to keep it really quiet, because it was just so unpunk.
It's really hard going up those hills in drainpipe jeans and
with bondage trousers. Yeah, legs tied together.
But this folk revival thing kind of edges us towards who we our guest today, really, doesn't it? In fact, there's lots of connections that we have.
There are so many connections. This guy is like, he is such a raconteur's archetype. In what he covers, you know, and with both of us, Gary, and in so many areas down to, you know, the band we're in. And in fact, I've got, what I'd like to say about him is this guy is, not only was he in the room where it happens, but the chances are he'd hired the room where it happens.
Absolutely. You're talking about the UFO Club where Pink Floyd started, him and Hoppy Hopkins, or you know, they opened that club as young people, as young kids. I think, you know, he's an American, and he'd come over America. He's American, right?
He's American. Fantastically, that American folk blues background, which was very, very academic and intellectual. You know, he started promoting gigs at Harvard.
Then came over, started the UFO Club, started psychedelia, pretty much. Produce those early Pink Floyd records. Well, certainly Arnold Lane.
And Candy in a Current Bun.
And put them in the room. Made them the house band of the UFO Club.
Because he was setting up Elektra Records then.
Went on to produce Fairport Convention, all their best albums with Richard Thompson. And of course, Nick Drake. You know, all of Nick Drake's wonderful records that we cling on to now. The only three albums he ever made. Right the way through to Toots and the Maytales and R.E.M. I mean, it's a pretty good career. He wrote a fantastic book, didn't he?
No, he wrote, and in fact, his book, White Bicycles, has probably been referred to on Raconteurs more than any other music book, because there's so much stuff in it. It is literally like, it's like a textbook. When people do the Raconteurs A-level in years to come, then White Bicycles will be the first book in the course reading.
I've got too much on. I can't do any marking.
Let's get him on.
Welcome to the Raconteurs.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
That's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I've been sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
That caused a big problem in the band, actually. I was having too much fun.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it, and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Raconteurs Podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Yay!
Yeah, there we are. Okay.
Hello, Joe, and welcome.
Hi there.
Hi there.
Lovely to see you. Long time. I can't think of the last time I saw you.
Well, I was just telling Guy how I fanboyed you after I read White Bicycles and got in touch and we met up at the Groucho Club.
That's right, yeah. You're a friend of Steve Woolley's, aren't you?
That's right. Steve Woolley from Palace Pictures, the film producer. Yeah, he put Spandau Ballet on at Scala when it was, you know, when we were those hip young things coming out of a club not that far away from where you started your club.
I was just saying, Joe, in fact, that it's in over the course of the series, your book gets referred to more than any other tome.
That's good.
It's literally like the sort of key text for Rock on Tours.
That's very nice to hear. And as I may have mentioned, I thought, oh, that's nice. I'll write another book. That was 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And the new book is coming out in June.
So tell us about it.
The book is called And the Roots of Rhythm Remain, A Journey Through Global Music.
Because you were very much at the heart of, now I can't say world music, I'm going to get stuck every now and again, of global music. Although
I'm trying to find what, there clearly is some very important semantic distinction between world
and the globe. Well, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous that the Grammys, for example, changed the name of World Music Album of the Year to Global Music Album of the Year, as if that makes a difference.
Well, that includes the Western music then, surely, if it's global.
Well, exactly. Well, that's the issue. But, you know, as I point out at one, I mean, the world music scene of the 1980s and 90s makes up a very small part of my book.
Yeah.
Most of it is about the backstory. Back to 1853, when Charles Dickens gave a scathing review to a Zulu choir that was a huge hit. In London.
Wow.
In 1853.
Amazing.
What was he comparing his Zulus to? You know, I mean, it was like...
Well, but it's kind of interesting. I mean, this, don't get me started. But, you know, the 19th century, a lot of people were kind of felt like culture had come to a dead end, that it needed injection of the primitive or the naive or the exotic in order to revive Western culture. And so people were very interested in the primitive. And Charles Dickens said, no, these primitive Zulus, in his words, should be civilized off the face of the earth.
Do you know, it's interesting what you're just saying.
Simpler times, simpler times, you know.
My 19-year-old is doing music up at Edinburgh, and he was down last week, and he said, I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm doing an essay on 19th century classical music and how they were trying to harness or evoke folk music, because there was a sense that culture had kind of, you know, had gone to its extremes, and that they had to find working class music, popular music, to embrace it.
Well, that was,
and they made
Sibelius, Liszt, Smetana, Janáček, Bartók,
and sometimes even making it up, you know.
Yeah. No, that's a lot what my book is about. And in fact, I mean, it's as you say, it was an innocent, simpler time when your son probably, he may reference, he should reference Johann Herder, who was a German philosopher, who was the one who basically said that the soul of the people lies in the folk tales and music of the peasants. And in a way, that's the beginning of nationalism, which was a very liberal idea.
Yes.
Nationalism was liberal.
Is that because the
kings?
Is that to do with the fact that the nation state wasn't the be all and end all in Europe?
Well, I mean, in those days, you were the subject of a king.
Yeah.
And Herder and the French Revolution were saying, no, you know, there's a people that grows from the soil and the culture of the soil, etc. Anyway.
And then you'd get books like The Golden Bough, you know, which were, you know, I forgot who wrote The Golden Bough now. It's
Fraser,
you know, compiling myths and legends and trying to find something to do with our ancient past and trying to connect with that. But
And it was a very shocking book because it basically said that, you know, Christ's crucifixion was just one of dozens of springtime sacrifices which were meant to fertilize crops, and that that legend went back thousands of years.
Right, right, right. But bringing it...
So that put the cat among the pigeons with the Christians.
Yeah. Well, bringing it back into our world, you know, if we're going to look... Well, seriously, because if we're going to look at...
This is a very, very academic rock on tours. It's fantastic.
I'm sure this is in your book as well, because Mike Heron and the Incredible String Band, which we'll get on to, you know, this is a band probably that is introducing global instruments, if you like, into Western music, and would have, and probably with the influences of the Beatles and the Stones, as far as taking music from other countries was concerned, and introducing it into our own folk music.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think, in a way, the most central moment, you know, our equivalent of the thing we're talking about in the 19th century, the 20th century equivalent, is very well articulated in Bob Dylan's book, Chronicles, when he talks about staying in some friend's flat for a week or something and discovering that they've got the Harry Smith, and he listens to the Harry Smith anthology of American folk music, and his life is changed. And that is, he describes how that touch of authenticity, of real powerful message from, you know, the Mississippi Delta and the Appalachian Mountains, changed his whole approach to music. And that, in a way, led to Newport and the electric guitar in a, you know...
Which you were at, in of a course.
Way. I was going to say, because would you say... It's interesting seeing where you're at now, Joe, with this book and the way you're appraising the history of music, is that because where you started was actually quite... could be viewed as an academic viewpoint of the blues and jazz and folk music back at Harvard, right? Wasn't it the way that you guys were approaching it over there? So it was a kind of research-based thing. I heard Elvis and, oh my God, you know.
But that means it was part of the zeitgeist, or were you feeding off of Dylan and his cohorts?
Yeah, I mean, I spent in my teens, my brother and I and Jeff Muldaur, who you may have heard of, who was, you know, the lead singer for Butterfield for a while. And, you know, we would sit around and listen to old blues records and old jazz records. And it was kind of a nerdy sideline, you know. Then we'd get spruced up and go to a party that night and dance to Chuck Berry and Little Richard and Fats Domino. And in a way, the beginning of my quest to be a record producer was that, you know, I saw these two worlds at the time when I was 16, you know, I saw these two worlds as completely separate. There was this nerdy academic thing that you're talking about, listening to old 78s. And then there was rock and roll, which was, I loved equally. Mm-hmm. And then I read a book by Sam Charters called The Country Blues. And he talks about Ralph Peer, who was the first real powerful record producer as such, who went through the South recording blues singers. And he's the one who organized the big Bristol, Virginia days when they discovered Jimmy Rogers and the Carter family all in one afternoon. He was the heroic record producer. And I remember reading about that and saying, wow, it's such a shame that I'm born too late to be Ralph Peer. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly there was a moment when I was on the second string on the baseball team, and I realized I would never be a baseball star. And I was feeling pissed off about that. And I heard Fats Domino's walking to New Orleans, coming through the window of a nearby building from the local pop station. And I suddenly went, wait a minute, I could be Ralph Peer today. Fats Domino's from New Orleans. He's just like the modern Jelly Roll Morton. He's just, you know, it's all a continuity. It's all a continuum. Nothing has changed. It's still possible. And so I set out at that point at age 16. My father, when I graduated from high school, he said, do you have any plans for what you want to do in life? And I said, yeah, I'm going to be a record producer. And he had no idea what that was. And, you know, and not that, you know, very few people sort of talked about it then. And I remember my father asking me, he said, how many people in the world today, this was 1959, 60, how many people in the world today are doing that job in the way that you imagine yourself doing it? And I said, I don't know, 12? And he said, okay. So you're shooting for a very, very small target.
Yeah, yeah. You know, so there's another part of this story which kind of hinges on what we were talking about earlier. And I'm guessing sort of the English version of Ralph Peer would have been Cecil Sharp a little bit earlier.
Well, the difference is Cecil Sharp was an academic. I mean, he was. And there's a really, really fascinating, important. There's a film called American Epic, which was on the BBC maybe 10 years ago. And it's actually made by an Irish and Scottish-Irish couple of filmmakers. And T-Bone Burnett was the music producer in the film. And it starts with this machine that this weird guy in Santa Monica, based on photographs and diagrams, he built an electric recorder the way that they had one in 1925, because they're all in the junkyard now, the yeah. ones that were used back then. But this was the first moment when recording went from acoustic, which is just the way a vibration passes into a needle and soft wax, to electric, which uses the electric signal to vibrate the needle and the soft wax. And that changed the quality of records. Suddenly, they became much more vivid and much more impactful.
Was that the beginning of the microphone as well?
Yeah, the electric microphone,
Because the story is that before the microphone, you needed an Al Jolson to reach the gods and to shout into a megaphone. But once you had a microphone, you could sing quiet. And apparently, the gentlemen were outraged, husbands were outraged, because this guy was whispering songs down a radio at his wife.
Whispering into her ear,
the crooners, because of a microphone.
But the fascinating thing about that moment, though, is that, it was exactly because it was also the radio and the record business. When network radio started in America and you suddenly had bands playing in New York and being heard all over the country at the same time, the record people thought it's the end of the world. Why would anybody ever buy a record again? Because they can just turn on the radio and hear their favorite songs. And so Ralph Peer had the idea, well, maybe that's what's going to happen. But in the meantime, there's millions of people who don't have electricity. They're out there in the boondocks and they have wind-up gramophones. So at least we can keep making records for them.
Mm-hmm. And so that's make sure these people never get electricity.
Yeah. He went out. Well, he figured this is the last gasp of the record business. He went out and recorded Delta blues and country Appalachian. And much to their astonishment, because at that time they thought, if you're going to sell blues, you have to have it with a band. You have to have like a, Ma Rainey, Bessie Smith kind of blues shouter. It has to be urban music. And these records sold like crazy. And it changed everything. And suddenly authenticity and not having a big band arrangement of something and country music and blues and Cajun and Hawaiian and all this stuff started selling. And Ralph Peer was the guy.
And do you think your fascination with him led you to be the main producer of the folk boom in Britain in the late 60s, early 70s?
I mean, I think I get in arguments with people sometimes who have an over-conceptual view that they accuse listeners of having a concept of what they want to hear or what they want to produce. To me, it works the other way around. I listened to things and there were certain things that I loved and certain things that I didn't love as much. And then I would try and figure out what are the qualities in common of the things that I love. And it turned out that the things that were in common very often were roots and authenticity. And so I would follow that more. And the same thing happened, when I was at Newport and Dylan plugged in his electric guitar, I was thrilled. I thought it was very exciting. But I was even more excited in a way by hearing Mississippi John Hurt and by hearing Son House. And that was to me, and that's where the Ralph Peer connection comes in, where it's different from Cecil Sharp, because Ralph Peer was always thinking, how do I record this music well enough that it'll sell? And I was always thinking that, like, how do you take this great music that I hear in the folk clubs of Britain and present it in a way that is true to the music, but also dressed up sonically and packaged and promoted in a way that will reach people?
That sort of answers the question, because I was wondering how different Peer was to, say, Alan Lomax. And I guess Lomax was just about sort of recording.
Exactly. And, the battle of Newport in 1965 was a battle between Lomax, who was there in person, and Ralph Peer, who had died, but was there in the persona of Dylan and Butterfield and all those people. And it was this clash of sensibilities.
But I guess those early blues guys would have gladly have taken an electric guitar if they could have taken one. It was just all they had was acoustic. And do you think, though,
but you had, like, you toured with people like Rosetta Sharp and stuff, what it was all about.
Yeah, exactly.
My question was going to be, Pete Seeger and that crowd of sort of middle-class intellectuals, do you feel that this is the same people that were in the 19th century saying, right, we need to go back and embrace some popular culture, that there was that they were trying to hang on to things that they felt were rootsy but not modern? Because
I think with Seeger it's a little more complicated because it's political. I think Seeger, you know, this idea, in a way, it's connected to Herder and Sibelius and all that stuff, but in a different way, in that it's workers of the world unite. And the weird thing about Seeger was his idea that you hear in the Weavers, those arrangements. I mean, I talked to him about it. He fanatically believed that you had to give people songs that they could sing themselves around a campfire on a picket line, you know, at a demonstration.
But he hated real popular music. He probably hated what the working classes were actually listening to and wanted.
Well, yeah, he hated the idea of, you know, basically turning people into listeners rather than participants. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when Bob Dylan is blasting out Maggie's Farm with his electric guitar with a drum kit, you know, that nobody's... There's a fantastic film, I don't know if you've ever seen it, called The Other Side of the Mirror. And it's basically a compilation. You know, there was a film crew at the Newport Folk Festival, 63, 64, and 65. And they made a film of Murray Lerner directed, made a film called Festival, which is about Newport.
All right.
And then years later, he took all his outtakes of Dylan from 63, 64, and 65 and put them together. So you see Dylan in 63, the young guy with the acoustic guitar singing a ballad about mine workers.
Yeah, very woody.
And yeah, exactly. And Dylan and Seeger and Theodore Bickel and Alan Lomax sitting around looking at him in wonder, like, isn't this great?
Yeah.
And then you have 64, there was a workshop, and Pete Seeger introduces Dylan as the voice of a generation. And Dylan gets up on stage and he sings Mr. Tambourine Man. And the camera is very tight on Dylan's face for the first verse. And then at the end, as the chorus comes in, it pulls back and you see Pete Seeger sitting on the stage behind Dylan.
Head in hand.
Head in hand. Like, what the hell is this? This isn't a song about workers. This isn't a song about justice. This is Dylan, in, you know, weird take on his own internal life, you know? And how are we going to, what's this got to do with Blowing in the Wind? Nothing. And you could see that's the moment when it all started to go pear-shaped for Seeger and that.
How wrong can he be? I mean, folks, rock music, nothing is more democratized music for the masses than popular music has. You know, anyone can pick up a guitar.
Oh, yeah, but music has always been popular. I mean, music has always been music of the masses. That's what... And the fascinating thing, which I've later learned in my research for the new book, at that performance in 1964 at the Newport Festival, in the audience was a guy called Jim Dixon. And Jim Dixon went to Albert Grossman, to Dylan's manager, afterwards. And he said, can you get me a tape of that song?
Oh, right.
And he eventually got it and cut a demo on it and brought it back to L.A. to the group that he was producing.
The Birds.
Ah. We were called the Beefeaters, who changed their name to the Birds.
Wow.
And they all, McGuinn and the Clarks and Hillman, all loved the idea of recording Mr. Tambourine Man, but David Crosby refused. He said, no, I don't like it. I don't want it. I don't think it's right. I don't think we should do it.
I think he told us that on this show, didn't he?
Yeah.
And Dixon discovered that Dylan was coming to L.A. And so he persuaded Grossman to bring Dylan around to the rehearsal studio where the Birds were rehearsing. And he got them to play Mr. Tambourine Man to Dylan. And Dylan said, wow, man, you could dance to that. And his enthusiasm convinced Crosby. And Crosby said, okay, we'll record it.
Amazing.
What were you
this
doing?
This is the thing I was finding, just one tiny little sidebar. The thing I always find slightly ironic that gets lost in the mix with Dylan was that after he broke through to the mainstream, that there was that whole period where he was literally like the most covered pop song artist in the world. It was like he was a Max Martin or something.
Yeah.
It's really, really bizarre.
It was one of the central things about it was his motor, you know, he had that motorcycle accident.
Yeah.
And so he couldn't tour. And Grossman was desperate to get income to keep the thing going. You know, there was a lot of overheads. And he persuaded, that's how the Basement Tapes came about, that he made, they were demos of new songs that he'd written. And a pressed LP of 12 of those songs was sent to Feldman Music in London. And they had a little listening booth in the office in Feldman Music, which was right opposite Denmark Street on Charing Cross Road. And, you know, Brian Auger came down and heard This Wheel's on Fire and had a number top five hit with that. Manfred Mann came down and heard Mighty Quinn the Eskimo, had a hit like that. I brought the Fairport Convention in. We listened and we recorded, you know, Million Dollar Bash and a couple of other of those things off that. And it was like the ultimate, the last gasp of Tin Pan Alley, you know, of, you know, people, almost like the old days of somebody playing the piano, playing all the new tunes.
But it's also true to say that Americana kind of maxed out at that point. And it was really that it was then that Fairport thought, well, where else can you go? Maybe we can go into English folk music. Is that true?
Yeah. Well, that was triggered by the car accident. The van crashed and the drummer was killed. Martin Lambert was killed. And they felt we will never perform those songs that we did with Martin again. So they needed a whole new repertoire. And the biggest exciting track off their On Half Bricking album was The Sailor's Life, which was a British folk tune. And they just decided to follow that path.
But, okay, so hang on, because we're jumping a bit here, because what I'm very, very keen to do, Joe, is that we need to get you into London when you just got to London and what you're going to do, because, you know, this is...
Right.
Because this is where you shaped the world. You certainly shaped my world.
Yes.
Well, I had this, you know, as I said, I had this quest. I wanted to be a record producer. I got off to a great start working for George Wein as a tour manager. Mm-hmm. I brought Muddy Waters and Sister Rosetta Tharpe to Britain, and I toured Coleman Hawkins and Miles Davis and people as a tour manager that autumn. And George was happy with me. You know, he thought I did a good job. So that's how I got to be the production manager at Newport the following summer. And, but all the time I was maneuvering, you know, and I'd heard Paul Butterfield in Chicago, and I introduced my friend Paul Rothschild, the great producer who produced the Janis Joplin Pearl album, and The Doors, all The Doors records were produced by Paul Rothschild. And he was came out of the folk scene in Boston, where I met him. And he was a great guy and a fantastic producer. I mean, to me, Strange Days is one of the best sounding records ever made.
Yeah.
Anyway, I turned Paul on to the Paul Butterfield Band, and he signed them to Elektra. So he owed me. And then he came up and mixed the sound at Newport that summer. I was on stage. He was at the soundboard when Dylan went electric. And then afterwards, he introduced me to Jack Holtzman, who was the head of Elektra. And Holtzman said, I've been to England. I spent a lot of time in England that year. Holtzman said, so how's Elektra in England? What's the image like? What's the presence like? I said, it's crap. Your records cost a pound more than everybody else's. There's no promotion. Your artists never come. You know, it's a joke. And like 3 weeks later, I got a call from Rothschild saying, can you come up to the office? And I went up to the office and he took me in to see Jack. And the two of them sat there and said, how'd you like to go to London and open up an office for Elektra? So I'd shot my mouth off and that got me a job. And so basically they had a distributor in Poland Street. They had a little warehouse right there in Poland, number 7 Poland Street. And they distributed Blue Note, Contemporary Records, and Elektra, and a few other things. And they gave me a little desk in the back. And we started manufacturing the key Elektra records locally, because before it had all been imported.
What artists?
So who are they?
It was the big artists were Judy Collins, Phil Oakes. I don't know. We had a big hit that winter, that first winter, with a record called The Baroque Beatles Book, which is an amazing record.
How so hilarious. London.
Yeah. It's like, it's just, you should look it up. It is unbelievable.
I just want to see the cover. I don't care about the record. I just want to see the cover because I know it's going to be fantastic.
Yeah. It's great. But the music is incredible because it was so witty, the way he took Beatles songs and arranged them like Vivaldi. And it was a big hit. Everybody bought it at Christmas time. And it was our first hit. And Tom Paxton, you know, that sort of thing. But because of Rothschild, he was in the middle of producing the Butterfield Band, and they'd already scrapped the first album. They made a whole album and they decided it wasn't good enough. They weren't going to release it. And they took the best tracks, and Rothschild had this idea to make an electric blues compilation, because he also had recorded The Loving Spoonful before they signed with Kama Sutra. So he had 4 tracks of Butterfield, 4 tracks of The Loving Spoonful, and a couple of tracks by Al Kooper and Tom Rush. And as I was leaving for London, I said, hold 3 or 4 tracks for me. I'll find a blues band in London and I'll fill out the compilation. And of course, I got there and found like every blues band that was any good had been signed by Decca, because they were so pissed off they'd missed the Beatles. You know, they signed every
scattergun.
And so I was struggling with my promise that I'd make, you know, and just at that moment, Paul Jones walked in the door of Elektra.
From Man for Man, is that right?
Yeah,
he was the lead singer of Man for Man. He's a guy who still does the BBC Blues Show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he had a tape of a guy called Ram John Holder, who was a Guyanese singer who'd made a gospel album, because Paul, as you may know, is a born-again Christian, and he liked gospel music. And so he'd made this Guyanese, Jamaican-ish gospel record, and he thought Elektra should put it out. And so while he was there pitching me on Ram John Holder, I mentioned the blues compilation with Butterfield and The Loving Spoonful, and he said, oh man, anybody would be gagging to be on that record. And so we sat there on the back of an envelope. He said, who do you want? I said, well, okay, how about Steve Winwood on vocals, Eric Clapton on guitar, Jack Bruce on bass, Ginger Baker on drums, you know, you can play harmonica and sing.
You're inventing cream, right?
Yeah. And we just did it on an envelope. And he said, I know all these guys. I'll sort it out for you. And so he walked out the door with his envelope. And I thought, well, that's the last I'm ever going to hear of him. And 2 days later, he calls me back and says, okay, we're all up for it, except Ginger's on tour. He's out of the country, so it'll have to be Pete York on drums. So like 4 days later, I'm in the studio making my first ever session as a producer with Eric Clapton.
And the Powerhouse, it was called, wasn't it?
Yeah, the Powerhouse. And in fact, we started talking about the material, and Eric and I were talking about, and he had all these ideas about Crosscut Saw and Albert King numbers, you know. And I said, nah, you know, that's John Mayall and all these guys. You've done that, you know, we should do something a bit different. What if you took, like, because I knew he really loved acoustic country blues. What if you took a country blues tune and brought it up the Mississippi to Chicago, even though it had never been there? And so we agreed to get together on a Saturday. I brought my LPs that I had of country blues, and he brought a few of that he had. And we sat there in the office playing country blues all day, one Saturday. And we agreed that the thing to do was Robert Johnson. And so I suggested Standing at the Crossroads, and he liked Traveling Riverside Blues. And so anyway, he went away. And when he turned up at the set, at the rehearsal, we had a rehearsal, and he turned up at the rehearsal, he'd figured out a mixture of the two tracks, Standing at the Crossroads and Standing at the Crossroads with the lyric and the guitar lick from Traveling Riverside. And that is Crossroads.
Wow.
That he later, you know, was his totemic track with Cream. But we recorded it first for Powerhouse, for this compilation, with Stevie Winwood singing the lyric.
Oh.
It's a great track.
And he's about 16 years old, right? 17 or something.
Yeah. 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 And we had to call him Stevie Anglo. And that's how I met Chris Blackwell, because I had to get his permission to use Stevie because he was under contract to Phillips through Island.
Yeah.
And so Chris said, well, I might get in trouble with Phillips if he used his real name, so call him Stevie Anglo.
Fantastic.
And did you find out what production meant to you at that point? What your role was?
Yeah. I mean, I'd been in the studio with Rothschild. I'd apprenticed with Rothschild. He let me keep the track listing on the back of the boxes. So I'd sit there, you know, when he made records in New York before we left for England. And then when I'd been in England that year before Newport, I'd stayed for a while on the couch of Bill Leader, who was the producer who did all of Topics records. And people used to come in, like the Watersons, and record in his kitchen. And he'd put egg crates up on the wall and hang a blanket and stuff. And so I had both sides of that coin. But Bill was fantastic, the way he treated everybody with respect, the way he provided kind of, I don't know, I felt like they knew how much he loved the music. And so the power of his affection equaled the power of playing in front of an audience. You know, it got that sort of in the moment intensity into the performance. And so that's what I learned from Bill Leader. And then, of course, I learned a lot of the other stuff from Paul Rothschild. But when I got in the studio that first time, I mean, I was so lucky because I that first time with Eric Clapton, Keith Grant, I asked Bill Leader, where should I record this group? And he said, you should try Olympic. It was still in George Street then. It was in the West End. It hadn't moved to Barnes. And he said, that's Keith Grant. He knew Keith Grant. You know, the kind of brotherhood of recording world. So I was able to call Keith Grant. Hey, Bill Leader sent me, blah, blah, blah. I got this session. And so Keith Grant did all, you know, I never learned how to be an engineer. You know, in these days, sometimes when people come up to me and say, oh, I love Nick Drake, and they ask me about how I got into producing, they say, were you a musician or were you an engineer before you became a producer? And I say, neither. And they look at me like, huh? What do you mean? How could you be a producer? And they don't understand like me and Denny Cordell and Paul Rothschild and Ralph Peer, John Hammond, you know, I mean, nobody was a musician or an engineer.
You had passion. It was often
the manager would be the producer.
Well, like Andrew Lou Goldham.
Or Andrew Lou Goldham, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, Andrew Oldham. I mean, I still, to this day, I love the early Stones. I have a way of listening to music in alphabetical order. I'm loading everything onto a hard drive, and I listen to everything in the alphabetical order by song title. And so I'm on SAL at the moment. And this morning, as I was making my breakfast, I was listening to Salt of the Earth. What a great song. And what a great, you know, when you have Brian Jones and Andrew Oldham still in the mix.
Yeah.
It's a whole other deal with the song. Anyway.
So Joe, I want to push you on into, I've got a feeling that Incredible String Band came before your sort of Pink Floyd UFO moment, did it?
Yeah. What happened there was, it was during the spring before Newport, spring of 65. And Bill Leader was going up to Northumberland to record the Fisher family, Archie Fisher and his sisters, for an album for Topic. Wonderful album. And so I tagged along. And in fact, I took the photo, the cover photo that Topic used, I took. And then Bill was going to turn around and go back to London. And I said, I think I'll hitchhike. I've never been to Scotland. So he gave me the name of a folk singer he knew, Delina McLennan, in Edinburgh. And he said, call her up. She'll hook you up with the folk clubs and the scene in Edinburgh. And so I hitchhiked to Edinburgh. And when I got to the edge of town, I went into a phone box and I called Delina. And she said, oh, well, you can stay on our sofa. Come on over. And so I arrived over. And the next thing I knew, they were having a party. And just to celebrate my arrival, you know, it was any excuse in Edinburgh to have a party. And Delina's boyfriend said to me, I'm going to take you to a folk club tomorrow night. We're going to hear some music you might like. And we walked for miles through these cobblestone streets of Edinburgh to this tiny pub. And there was a back room, sawdust on the floor, stools, no chairs. And the group playing was Robin and Clive. It was Robin Williamson and Clive Palmer. And I was kind of intrigued by them because they played Scottish tunes, but kind of as if they'd gone to the Appalachians and then come back, kind of. You know, there was just and Clive Palmer was a very good ragtime banjo player. And there was just something weird. It was like Appalachian music that Appalachia had never heard. And I said to myself, one day, if I ever am in a position to sign people up, I'm going to come and sign Robin and Clive. And with 6 months later, I was back with an Elektra, a desk, calling myself Elektra Records UK. And it turned out, of course, that I was Jack Holtzman's worst nightmare, because he basically said my job was to promote Phil Oakes and Judy Collins and Paul Butterfield.
Sign some hits.
He said, if you know, you can make a record or two, but don't go wild, you know, just keep, you know, focus on your main job. And so, of course, all I wanted to do was make records. And so I told him I wanted to sign. I went up to Glasgow. I found Robin and Clive. They'd added Mike Heron. They'd become the Incredible String Band. I wanted to sign them. And I offered them, Jack authorized me to offer them £50 advance. And Nat Joseph at Transatlantic Records had also heard about them and offered them £75. And I had to completely disobey Jack Holtzman and offer them £100 advance so that to get to trump Nat Joseph's offer. So we made the first Incredible String Band record, and it really sold. It sold really well.
I mean, if you want to know what they look like, if anyone out there has not seen that, I mean, the greatest, one of the greatest images of any hippies in a forest is the back of the Hangman's Beautiful Daughter, isn't it? I mean, it's the family and they're in their medieval clothes. I mean, but it somehow ended up in the sort of psychedelic world as well, didn't it?
They were playing nothing but folk clubs. And when I eventually, Jack fired me, but I decided to stay in England. And I was able to, the things that I was doing to keep to pay my rent was manage the Incredible String Band and run UFO with Hoppy and the UFO Club. And
come on.
Yeah, yeah. And so I was the one who said, the Incredible String Band should open for Pink Floyd.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
We want to know how the UFO Club came about. What was it about?
Pink Floyd, the day one, the start.
Okay. Who was Hoppy Hopkins? It all goes back to the blues and gospel tour, spring of 64, playing the Fairfield Hall, Croydon. Melody Maker sends a photographer to take pictures. The photographer's named John Hopkins. Great guy. He and I hit it off like a house on fire. I offer him tickets to the show. He says, I can't come tonight, but I'd love to come to the Hammersmith show next week. So I got him tickets for him and his girlfriend. And so we bonded. And we remained friends. And I slept on his sofa when I ran out of money, waiting for George Wein to put me back on the payroll. Hoppy and I were great mates. He was starting to be active in what we would call the underground. And while I was off at Newport and working for George Wein in the summer of 65, he helped organize the Poetry Olympics at the Albert Hall.
With Ginsberg.
And that spawned all this energy in the so-called the beginning of the underground scene.
Which, don't we think this is one that is actually an event at a major, major venue, which is based around poetry, which is the kickoff of everything, which I just think is so fantastic.
It was full. Yeah. You see the pictures there, everybody sitting on the floor. It was just a complete incredible thing. And I missed it because I was in America. But when I got back to London, the first thing I did when I arrived to take up my post at Elektra, I called Hoppy. And he said, what are you doing tomorrow night? Come on over, we're having a meeting. And so I went over, and there was a meeting with Miles and Peter Jenner and Andrew King, and it was about starting something called the London Free School, which was this very idealistic thing, was going to organize people in the Notting Hill area. The privileged middle class were going to help the West Indians and the Poles and the Irish, give classes, help them with paperwork to claim benefits that they were missing out on. I don't know, all kinds of ideas. And I didn't really participate much. I wrote a few things for them, and I was always trying to be helpful, but I had a full-time job. Then they decided to raise money by having a concert. There was right across, they had a tiny basement office in Palace Gardens, and right across the street was this church, this beautiful old church. And behind the church, there used to be a hall, which is now replaced by a block of flats. But in that hall, at the beginning of September 66, they started having these benefit concerts, like every couple of weeks or every 3 weeks or something. And Peter Jenner said, hey, there's a group of kids from Cambridge who are looking for a gig. I might even manage them. They're called Pink Floyd. And so they were the group that played. And of course, the Notting Hill Freaks loved them. And then I got fired by Elektra. And I felt like, and in fact, I think I'd introduced Jenner to Jack Holtzman, and he came to hear them when they did a kind of something at the Marquee Club, and he passed on them.
Because it was the UFO where they started the sort of long form psychedelia stuff.
They were doing that in Power Square before that was what they were doing. They had a bit of lights. Joe Gannon was doing his light projections and stuff. And I brought Chris Blackwell down, who I'd met because of Stevie Anglo, and he didn't like them either.
Stevie Winwood, yeah.
And And then I brought Horst Schmalzi down. And Horst Schmalzi is one of the great unknown heroes of British rock and roll. Horst Schmalzi created what we know of as the whole second wave of British rock, in a way. When I first arrived, the British major labels were EMI and Decca, and Pi as a kind of wannabe. Pi had the Kinks, Decca had the Stones, EMI had the Beatles. And then up comes the upstart Polydor. They open an
from
office.
From Germany, yeah.
From Germany. And they send this guy, Horst Schmalzi, in to run the London office.
Right. That's yes. Sorry, yes.
And you know, I lost out on Pink Floyd ultimately because EMI signed them and wouldn't allow outside producers to touch them. They wanted them all done in-house. That was Decca's MO, that was EMI's MO. Everything had to be the old-fashioned way. You know, you have and EMI, you know, had the engineers in the lab coats.
Yeah.
And he gave Lambert and Stamp their own label.
Right, Track.
He funded Track Records. And that's what lured The Who away from Decca to Polydor. And then they signed Hendrix. He gave them the money to do that. And then he gave Stigwood a deal for Cream. And he gave Giorgio Gomolsky the deal for Marmalade Records, which had the hit with Julie Driscoll and Brian Auger, This Wheel's on Fire. I mean,
yeah,
hits were coming right and left because he broke the mold.
Right.
He was an independent production empire. He let everybody do their thing. He gave them the money, go away, bring me back the master, I'll promote it. He was a great guy, and he was heroic. And he said, yes, of course. He wanted to sign Pink Floyd. And we had a deal for me to set up. I set up Witch Season Productions, Pink Floyd. We drew up the contracts. Pink Floyd was going to sign to Polydor through Witch Season. And then Jenner decided they needed an agent. And so they brought in Brian Morrison. And Brian just took one look at the situation. And I think he was on kickbacks from EMI or something. And he said, no, you're not signing with no Polydor. I'll get you a better deal. But they hired me to make the first record. And I tried to get them to commit that I would be the producer of the album if it was a hit. But Brian Morrison said, no, we can't get into that.
But you produced,
we don't want our hands tied.
So you produced Arnold Lane. But let's just go back before, because UFO Club was before that, surely.
Well, what happened, the chronology was September, Palace Square benefits for the London Free School. November, Hoppy and Miles launched the International Times, and they rented the Roundhouse for the launch party. So we had like four London Free School benefits, September and October and early November, where Pink Floyd played.
Isn't that one where, the International Times thing at the Roundhouse, isn't that... Is that the one where I'm sort of Nick tells the story of there was literally no power and they were basically like plugged? They had a plug going to someone's flat around the corner or something.
I have no memory of that. I think that might have happened later when Nicky was. I think he was too young to remember something like that. But so November they had the launch, which was a great event, and Pink Floyd and Soft Machine both played, and it just had a great atmosphere. And so I'd just come back to London. When I got fired by Elektra, I immediately went on tour with George Ween. I called George. I said, I'm available. He said, come on the road. We need you for this European Newport in Europe thing. So I went all around Europe for 3 weeks, and then I came back with some money. And Hoppy and I got together, and Hoppy had decided to stop taking photographs for Melody Maker and The Times and all the other people, because he wanted to focus entirely on the International Times and the London Free School. But there was no income. How are we going to pay our rent? And so I said, well, maybe what if we did something like the International Times launch party and charged admission? And he said, yeah, that's a good idea. And so we got in his Mini and we started going around London to all these venues. And he called me up. He said, let's go. I got a new idea today. I've talked to this guy. And we drove in. And in those days, you just drove into the West End and parked. We parked right in front of the Blarney Club in Tottenham Court Road, went down the stairs and met Mr. Gannon.
What is it now? What's that building now?
It's gone now.
What's there now?
It was an Odeon cinema.
That little cinema.
Yeah, the little cinema in the cement block there. Yeah. Gannon agreed to rent us the club for two Friday nights, December 23rd, December 30th, 66, £15 a week. And so we decided to give it a try. We handed out leaflets in Portobello Road, and we had no idea what...
Did you go to Nigel at that point, Weymouth?
No, not yet. We just had this two-week trial to see if it was going to work.
And it's a Christmas night, right?
Yeah, so it was two nights before Christmas. And we had a great crowd, and it was all freaks. It was all basically, and the freaks were all astonished that there were so many of them. It was like they didn't know that there was other like-minded people around. Sorry. And so we decided, okay, we're going to turn this into a thing. This is going to be how we pay our rent. And so we booked it again starting the middle of January. And that's when we said we need a poster, because we were aware, you know, Hoppy's partner in International Times was Barry Miles, mm-hmm. who was running Indica Books. And they had Village Voice, the East Village Other, the Berkeley Barb. They had all these underground papers from America. So we knew that there were all these posters around San Francisco for the Fillmore and the Family Dog and all this. And we said, let's get a poster. And so Hoppy said, I know the guy to design it, Michael English. And I said, I know the guy to design it, Nigel Weymouth. And this was the 60s. Right. So what did we do? We didn't argue about it. We said, they'll do it together. They'd never met.
So you put together Hapstash and the Colored Coat at that point.
Exactly.
Wow.
So we said, basically, Hoppy's guy and my guy, we brought them together. We told them, hey, you guys, the two of you, you do this together. And so we locked them in a room, and they came out with that brilliant, possibly the best they ever did, mm-hmm. the candy stripe, the peppermint stripe on the gold background, UFO. And we went to Vincent Stitt and paid him an outrageous sum of money to fly post the West End with those posters. And so the club was full.
There's a bit of footage of it. I mean, there was a film, wasn't there? Tonight,
it's all McLovin.
Yeah, but that just has very little. That's got just a little clip. I think the most thorough is a German film crew,
right,
from Radio Bremen, that has some footage. But there's not much footage. But it was great. I mean, we opened at 10:30 because that was part of the deal. Was upstairs. We were right underneath the Continental and the Barclay, which was a pair of art cinemas run by the same guy. And he told, you know, once he heard that we were going to have electric bands, he told Mr. Gannon that you can't start playing music until after 10:30. And so we opened at 10:30 and kept going till the tube started running again at 6.
Wow. Let's talk about Sid, because he's so important.
Yeah.
I don't know whether you know Guy. I'm sure you do, but you know, Guy and I play with Nick, and we do that early Floyd stuff. You know, but so Sid has been very much on our minds for the last few years. What was your experience of him, and how would you describe him?
It's very sad. I mean, Sid was brilliant. You know, I loved his songs. I loved his playing, his singing, everything. He was a little hard to talk to. But I always got along with him. We had a few very nice conversations because what happened was that all of that with the start of UFO was running in parallel with me trying to get them a deal from November, from the International Times party through the first two UFOs, through the start of the regular UFO. All that time, over those 2 months, I was running around to lawyers and Horst Schmaltzy and Peter Jenner, who was managing them, and trying to get this whole thing organized. And then we went in the studio, I think the end of January or beginning of February of 67. That was another incredible piece of good fortune, was that where I recorded the string band and where I recorded Floyd and where I recorded everything was this place in Chelsea called Sound Techniques, which had been built by a guy called John Wood. And John is still a great engineer. I just did an event with him at Cecil Sharp House 2 weeks ago where we did questions and answers.
Damn.
And John was classically trained and grumpy, but Sid really liked him and trusted him. I think that was his grumpiness made people trust him. It made me trust him, you know, because I knew I could say any old crazy thing, knowing that if he thought it was stupid, he'd say so. And somehow the team of me and John, I think Sid felt pretty, you know, Nick Mason years later did an interview for Austrian radio where he said that, you know, one of his, I mean, I this is, you know, easy to say with hindsight, but he did say that, you know, the rest of the group were really excited about EMI and about being pop stars and all of this. And that in a way, dumping me in favor of EMI was part of that. But that Sid was much more comfortable at Sound Techniques working with me and John than he ever was working with
Norman.
Wow.
Yeah, Norman.
Wow.
And the guys in lab coats at EMI, and that
authority,
and that things might have been different if they had stayed and kept making. You know,
that's quite a major thing to say. Because Arnold Lane is a fantastically assured recording. In fact, we have a thing, Joe, in our intro to this podcast. We have little snippets from previous interviews, and one of them is Nick Mason saying how the whole thing about the 2,000 hours of experience, that how when Pink Floyd went to do Arnold Lane, they'd actually only ever had about 50 hours of playing together.
Right. But it, you know, but the thing, I don't know. I mean, and I have to say that I think the Piper at the Gates of Dawn, I was so keen not to like it when it came out, but I did like it. I thought it was pretty good. And I think, there's some tracks on there that are just fantastic.
I just want to stay on Sid for a second because yeah. If it wasn't for Sid, you really feel that so much in rock music and what we've done in glam rock and in punk and in the New Romantics and all of that would never have happened. He was Bowie said that Sid made him who he is because he was a guy singing American rock music with a London voice.
Exactly. He sang as he spoke. And I think in a way, you know, I'm one of the people that I've written about in my new book, that's one of the heroes of the new book, is Joao Gilberto.
All right.
And one of the things about him that was so revolutionary in Brazil was that he sang as he spoke.
Like Charles Aznavour would have done, you know, and those chanteurs.
Yeah, although I think Aznavour had more of a kind of delivery. A kind of singer's delivery.
I still remember being absolutely gobsmacked finding out that the actual translation of Bossa Nova is New Wave.
Yeah.
but there's it's a little bit more than it is literally New Wave.
Yeah.
but there's something in Brazilian Portuguese that's a little more than just Wave.
Right. There's a common thread in three of your singers in a way that you've produced, and that is their own their great importance and their delicacy and their tragedy. So I'm talking about Sid, Sandy Denny, and Nick Drake.
Yeah,
is it you being drawn to those?
Sandy belted, and the other two didn't.
But is there something? Was it just a coincidence, or is there you're drawn to that kind of a performer?
I don't know. You know, I think. Again, you can always only make these generalizations in the rearview mirror to me. I mean, but I think Sandy was such a different character and such a different singer. You can draw parallels with Nick and Sid. They were both very fragile. They sang, you know, within themselves. They broke themselves against the wall of the society around them, whereas Sandy is very self-destructive, just her own under her own steam. So it's a different story in a way. But Nick and Sid as a parallel is certainly interesting. And I'm certainly always drawn to melody. And those two singers have really something arresting and different in their melodic sensibilities, you know, compared to everything else. You know, I'm always a bit freaked out when I go into a record store and I see Nick filed under folk, because, you know, he's not a folk singer at all. You know, There's a little bit of that Davy Graham guitar in there, but mostly it's, you know, he's much closer to, I don't know. I mean, his, I don't know, but it's not, it's very little to do with folk music in the harmonies or the melodies or anything like that. It's his very own sort of, I don't know, popular, high tone, popular music sensibility.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, but it's quite hard, so it's quite hard to know where they put it, if you've got to put him somewhere. Where?
Yeah, yeah.
And also, he's not a singer songwriter either. It's not that.
Yeah. No, it's not. That's no. Why I liked it, because yeah. I at the time I really didn't like singer songwriters. Yeah. I kind of came to England to get away from all these goddamn middle class singer songwriters, who Dylan to me was the exception that proved the rule. You know, these middle class people shouldn't be writing songs about their tortured, boring lives. But then, you know, Joni Mitchell came along and, you know, she was different and and the standard got right. And then I discovered Nick, you know, and then Richard's, you know, I didn't encourage Richard Thompson to start writing songs. You know, he just did and they were good. And yeah. So we put them in the repertoire and I resisted Sandy for a long time because she was too much like an American. And then she said she told me she written her first song, and so she played it to me. Who knows where the time goes?
Oh my god!
Yeah. On a slight sidebar, because there's something you said in your book which I've always quoted, which is it's perhaps a touch flippant, but it's my favorite ever description of what comprised a British band in the 60s. But you said a British band was basically four art students who learned instruments until they were at a sufficient level to play the songs that the most forceful of them had written.
Genius. Yeah.
Yeah. But you know, that to me that was one of the great things about Britain in a way, you know, that that was one of the things I really liked when I came over here, was that in America there's so many chances to jam. There's so many bars. There's so many places with live music. So many musicians work their way up through. They learn how to play country rock. I mean, this was in the old days. You know,
they're all over Instagram now. Don't worry.
Yeah. And they're good, but they're too good.
Yes.
You know, they kind of flatten everything out into something that sounds like a generic kind of American sound. And what you found in Britain, you know, were these eccentric individuals who weren't brilliant at their, I mean, later, so many British players got to be brilliant and could work anywhere in the world. But in the 60s, you know, a lot of the groups were, as I described in the book, they were different from the Americans because they weren't as good.
Well, you don't start with a covers band. You don't start in a cover. You don't start learning covers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You start playing these weird songs, which are written again without the rules.
What is interesting about, I think, I just want to hang on to Nick Drake, because he's such an important artist and he's been embraced so much by younger kids, sort of reinvented. And I think the reason for that is, in a way, like a sort of Byron Shelley, you know, this is a sort of a sense of a ironically, I was going to say new romanticism, but it's a kind of romanticism. He was singing about his own feelings and about himself. You know, Pete Townshend did it to a certain extent, but Roger sang it. The Beatles never did that. You know, I never felt that the Rolling Stones did that. And I think that's why Nick has been embraced by the sort of, you know, the society that we have now, where people are very, very tuned in to their own feelings and always wanting to express their own feelings. Nick was a person who did that, but took his life because it was such a struggle for him in a time where you weren't really allowed to do that.
Ray Davies did it.
Yeah.
A bit. It wasn't entirely, you know, unknown. But yeah, Nick was so intensely himself, you know, and I think also his music is somehow free to be embraced by every new generation because it's not a soundtrack for the 60s. You know, it never got locked into being, you know, there's something about the Jefferson Airplane that will always mean the 60s, you know, and Nick floats free of that.
Yeah,
But maybe part of that is it's people. Maybe it's the same thing could apply to Van Gogh or someone. It's people who aren't discovered in their lifetime.
Yeah, exactly.
So
exactly.
It gives them a sort of an impermanence.
That's right. And also, you know, just to mention, and we can't leave without mentioning Robert Kirby, the incredible strings that are on those Nick Drake.
Yeah,
that first album. I mean, the string arrangements are extraordinary. I mean, like nothing I've ever heard, even to this day. I mean, did you bring that to the mix, Joe?
No, I mean, that's such a classic story. When I first met Nick and heard three songs, he brought a demo of three songs. One of the records on my turntable at home at that time was Leonard Cohen's first album. And John Simon produced that record brilliantly. And there's something about a quiet, I mean, it's what we were talking about earlier with microphones, you know, a quiet voice, close mic, right up front in the mix, intimate, not a lot of reverb, not a lot of effects, very, very real sounding, warm sounding record. And when I heard Nick's first song of what John Simon did with Leonard Cohen, and I told him that, and he said, oh, I like the idea of strings. So he sort of embraced the idea. So then when we started to record, I called up Peter Asher and I said, who should I get to do a string arrangement? He had hired, my mind's going blank here, but the guy who did the arrangements for James Taylor's Apple record. And James Taylor made a record for Apple.
Yeah, that's right. His first album was Apple, yeah.
And so we went and sent him three songs and he did arrangements and we recorded them. And John Wood and Nick and I sat there in the studio after everybody left and we listened back to them and we said, didn't work. Wrong. And in those days, you know, you couldn't hear an arrangement. Nobody's going to send you a file with a keyboard, you know, approximation of what it's going to sound like. So we just had to take it on chance and listen and then go, oops, uh-oh, okay. And we were sort of scratching our head and looking depressed. And Nick then said, well, there's a guy at Cambridge who might be able to do it. And by this time, I knew Nick well enough to know that he wouldn't say anything casually. You know, if he said this, it was serious. So I agreed to come up to Cambridge and meet this guy. And, you know, there's not much you can do when you meet somebody, but I really liked this guy. He was studying Baroque music at Cambridge. And what finally, I didn't discover this till later, he'd actually done an arrangement for Nick to appear at a May ball at Cambridge. And he appeared with a string quartet at a May ball before we did that session. But Nick never told me that, you know, typical Nick. And so then we booked the strings. Robert told us, and John Wood, who loved the idea, because that's how he grew up, was as an engineer, was recording strings. And he booked London Philharmonic, or no, LSO people. He booked all LSO people. So he had, I think, a double string quartet or six strings or something for the first session. And we decided to start with Way to Blue, which is a song that Nick doesn't play on. It's just strings and voice. And I'm sitting up in the control room and John is down there arranging the microphones. And then he comes up and he listens to the viola and he listens to this, you know, all these different strings individually. And I'm going crazy because the lines I'm hearing are fantastic, but I can't hear it all together. And John, I keep saying, can I hear it all together? John said, keep your fucking pants on, Joe, you know, give me a chance to get the sound right, you know. And so finally, you know, he gets the sound on each instrument the way he wants. It pushes up all the faders and I swear I almost wept. Mm-hmm. You know, bet. It was just so beautiful.
There's nothing more extraordinary. I mean, it's a string arrangement. Yeah. It's just it's heartbreaking stuff. Joe, it's been so brilliant having you on. What's the name of your book, your new book?
And the Roots of Rhythm Remain.
I'm ordering
A Journey Through Global Music.
I'm ordering it now. Anyway, all the best, sir.
Okay, all the best. Bye-bye.
So lovely to see you, Joe. Cheers, mate. That was amazing. That was certainly one of the more, certainly started off as one of the more academic rock concerts we've ever had.
Yeah, can highly recommend both his last book, and I'm keen to read this next one as well.
Can't wait to read it. No, but White Bicycles, it is, as Brian Eno says on the cover, possibly the best book ever written about music.
And we never even mentioned Steve Howe's Tomorrow, White Bicycles. We never got to that.
Oh. It's the old didn't scratch the surface. What are you going to do? I mean, he's just too interesting.
He is, yeah. Anyway, listen, I'm looking forward to seeing you next week.
I'm looking forward to seeing you next week.
All right, all the best. And it's a good night from me.
And good night from them.
Rockanteurs is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions for Warner Music Group UK.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.